From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Our friends knew more about our sex lives than they did about our religious lives. I had best friends that knew, you know, what kind of sex toys my wife and I bought, but they didn't know that I prayed.
Today, we'll talk with a few people who are reaching across religious boundaries, across Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, so they can have open, honest conversations about their faiths and how religion can both divide us and unite us.
We're not theologians and we're not scholars and we're not politicians, and many of our conversations and the issues that we deal with are very much derived from real-life situations in family settings, whether the Easter Bunny visits Muslim children or not, or what does it
when
mean
when Suzanne read aloud her story, when she got to the part of the crucifixion, it stirred up some sort of very primal anxiety in me about Jews accused of being Christ killers. And I said to Suzanne, you know, this is really upsetting to me. And first I said, can you leave the crucifixion out? And she explained to me, in fact, that was rather a crucial element to her Christian beliefs.
That she was the first Jew I ever met, and I was 19. And so Judaism has always been a foreign country to me.
We are taught not to talk about God and politics. I mean, it's just bad manners, and I think that we just can't afford not to in this day and age.
It's true. Otherwise, it will be hijacked. If you don't have the conversation, it will be monopolized by others. You know, people say to us, where are all the moderates? They're there, and somebody has to give them a voice.
First, a step back in time to a largely forgotten Muslim society in which Jews, Christians, and Muslims all lived in relative harmony. Al-Andalus, on the peninsula that's now Spain and Portugal, was once Europe's most sophisticated culture. And as historian and novelist Tariq Ali told Steve Paulson, it remains a model for how different religions can coexist.
There existed in Western Europe Arab kingdoms, Islamic kingdoms, which were by and large tolerant, where you had three cultures, Islam, the dominant culture, Christianity, and Judaism, coexisting for several centuries. And it's not that, you know, they were always beautiful to each other. They argued and quarreled. But what is very interesting about this period is that Islam basically provided Jewish civilization and Jews with enormous shelter. And they were not attacked. There were no pogroms.
And this was a period when Jews were often persecuted in other parts of Europe.
Well, they were being persecuted in other parts of Europe. They had been expelled from Britain. There had been pogroms in parts of France on the way to the Crusades. But in Al-Andalus, they were looked after. They worked together with the Muslims. And it was from their history alone a peaceful period. At the same time, this was a period in which debate, discussion, and dissenting views flourished. Often the philosophers from each side debated in the big mosque in Cordoba. There were often debates involving Jewish and Christian philosophers with the Islamic philosophers. So from that point of view, it was a very productive period for the three cultures.
What centuries are we talking about when we refer to the
Andalus? We are basically talking from the 8th to the 15th centuries.
Nearly seven centuries, then.
Nearly seven centuries.
The one thing that's fascinating about this particular historical period is, I mean, you're describing all of this intellectual ferment in what is now Spain and Portugal. I mean, this is what is usually called the Dark Ages in the rest of Europe. I mean, this was the time of cultural and intellectual backwater before the Renaissance came on the scene, and yet it was precisely then when this Muslim-dominated society was flourishing.
Well, Islamic civilization from the 8th to the 12th centuries was the dominant Mediterranean civilization. This was the civilization which recovered the works of the ancients. All the texts from ancient Greece were translated into Arabic. In the town of Toledo, Tolai Tolai in the Arab world, they created a school of translators in the 9th century whose only job was to translate these texts and others from the original languages into Arabic. And so a lot of these documents survived merely because they were translated into Arabic, because lots of libraries were burned during wars, etc. And later it was then translated from the Arabic into Latin. And this was the bridge to the Renaissance. Arab civilization was the bridge. So the links between these civilizations are very close.
And yet what's curious is that my sense today is that most historians of Europe look at this whole period of Muslim domination on the Iberian Peninsula as almost a historical curiosity. I mean, yes, fascinating, but it didn't really have long-lasting significance to what Europe would later become.
Well, I think that's deeply shocking, actually, and shows what happened to the way in which history was seen, that history was always written by the victors. But if you read the texts, the great texts which followed the expulsions of the Muslims and the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, the famous Quixote by Cervantes, it is littered with references to what had happened, but literary critics in the West cannot understand it. I mean, to give you an example, the latest translation of the Quixote, I think it's by Edith Grossman, is just brilliant. Now, the introduction is by one of the United States' great literary scholars, Harold Bloom. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in his introduction does he mention the context in which Cervantes was writing of an ethnically cleansed society, nor does he mention that Cervantes came from a family of Jewish converts, conversos. The notion that the great modern novel, the man who created the first great modern novel in Europe, could be of Jewish origin is still not accepted by the Spanish Academy.
What happened to this Muslim society? Why did the Islamic dominance crumble?
Traditional Islamic historians will say we crumbled because the reconquest proved to be stronger than us. That is not the case, in my opinion. I think the principal reason that enabled the reconquest to triumph in Spain was the fratricidal civil wars that went on within Islamic civilization itself. Islam as a culture and as a religion and as a civilization could never create a stable society, historically, right from the beginning. And there was a conflict. The conflict, which became very strong in Spain, was between hardcore fundamentalists, the Berbers coming over from across the water in the Maghreb, North Africa, arriving in Cordoba and Medina al-Zahara, the great capital cities of the Cordoba Caliphate, and saying, but these people are not true Muslims. So the Puritan zeal, you know, very much not totally unlike the Protestant fundamentalist who fled England in the 17th century and came to North America.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a hypothetical question. Suppose Al-Andalus did not disappear in 1492. Suppose that it continued and it remained a presence in Europe, at least in that part of Europe, in what is today Spain, for centuries to come. How would European history be different?
Well, it would be totally different in the sense that you would have had three big civilizations existing in this peninsula. And they would have attracted a lot of refugees. For instance, to start off with, assuming nothing else was different, all the Jewish refugees who fled the pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia would probably have found refuge. Many of them would not have gone to where they finally went, Germany and France, but would have come to Al-Andalus. It would have been a big magnet. Secondly, Islam would probably have undergone a reformation.
Similar to the Christian church?
Probably. It wouldn't have been totally similar because the religions are different. But if it had remained in Al-Andalus, it would have undergone a reformation of sorts, as would have Peninsular Catholicism. Peninsular Catholicism remained untouched because they were united in this crusade against Jews and Muslims. Had they not been organized in that way, the reformation would probably have touched them as well. So the whole area would have been very different, and that would have made a big difference to the future of Europe.
Not just to Europe, presumably to the Middle East as well, to the Islamic world.
Because this would have been the most advanced outpost of Islam, and what was going on here would then have affected the Ottoman Empire.
Now, let me come back to the question of tolerance, because there is this image that there was a golden age of Al-Andalus when, as you've said, Jews, Muslims, and Christians all got along. And I know there's continuing debate about that, whether Jews and Christians had equal status to Muslims during that time. And obviously, there are tremendous contemporary implications for all of this, because there are a lot of people in the West who say that there's something about Islam that there's this drive within Islam to dominate, that Islam cannot coexist with other religious traditions, not to mention with secularists. So what does that history say about our current situation?
Well, in the first place, I'm never one of those who said it was a golden age. There were lots of problems, obviously, but nonetheless, compared to what followed it, it was very attractive. It is true that non-believers paid a poll tax, but this was very, you know, something quite minor. I mean, we're talking about a medieval world. For what it was a pretty tolerant world. And this notion that Islam only dominates and never coexists, if that had been true, they would never have lost. They would never have lost the Arab East to the Crusaders. They would not have lost Al-Andalus.
Well, they could have been defeated by their rival.
Well, but, you know, Islam was never a unified religion. And what forced it to unite at times was the Christian wars against it. In the Crusades, they did manage to unite and finally defeat the Crusaders. In Al-Andalus, they didn't. What we have going on today is the result of modern conflict. Conflicts which have arisen in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. This is nothing inherent in Islam itself, and this is something also which can be dealt with. And, you know, the other thing it's worth remembering, the largest Islamic state is Indonesia. Mm-hmm. Totally outside the world we're discussing. So that one cannot even say that there is one single dominant Islamic way of looking at the world, apart from in a very narrow sense. It's a very, very broad and a very diverse culture, and to see it exclusively as a Wahhabi, Saudi Arabian type Islam is wrong, because this represents a tiny minority within the Islamic world today.
Tariq Ali is a historian, novelist, and political commentator. He spoke with Steve Paulson. So, what can you do if you're troubled by the way certain religions are demonized? If you'd like to reach out across the religious divide and talk openly with people from other spiritual traditions? That was the quandary that brought together three women, Rania Idlibi, Suzanne Oliver, and Priscilla Warner, a Muslim, a Christian, and a Jew. After the horror of 9/11, they all felt the need to understand the other Abrahamic religions. So they met with the goal of writing a children's book together, and that led to a far more ambitious project, The Faith Club. Here's how Rania tells the story.
I came to The Faith Club right after the events of 9/11 out of a deep concern for my children and a sense of anxiety about their future as Americans and Muslims. It felt like Islam had become a burden, a religion that was more of a burden than a privilege. And as a mother, I knew one thing. I needed them to be proud. I needed to reach out and do something. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to connect with a Jewish and a Christian mother to do a project that would highlight the commonalities between our three faiths?
But if this happened right after 9/11, wasn't that also a scary time for you to try to connect with anyone outside the Islamic community?
Actually, it is precisely because I was so isolated, so desperate. The headlines were so alarmist, and there was a sense of aloneness. I like to say I hadn't even connected to a Muslim, American Muslim community. I had no mosque to turn to. Early on used to say I have temple and church envy. So it is precisely for that reason that once I did find my willing participants, I felt that they were rescuing me from my spiritual isolation. And no matter how difficult the conversation became, I for one knew that I was committed to it.
Am I right that the three of you did not know each other?
Correct.
When this idea began. How did you meet? Suzanne, how did you come into this?
I met Rania at the school bus stop. Our daughter started kindergarten together the week of 9/11. And like a lot of New Yorkers and Americans at the time, I was interested in learning more about Islam in the Middle East. And as I gradually learned that she was Palestinian, that she'd studied Middle Eastern politics, that she was Muslim of Middle Eastern descent, I was interested in hearing her point of view on what was going on in the world. And she mentioned this idea of getting the mothers together for this children's book. I really jumped at the opportunity after she had surprised me with these stories of commonality. It was news to me that Muslims trace their ancestry, religious ancestry, back to Abraham, like Christians and Jews do, that Muslims revere Jesus as a prophet.
And Priscilla, how did you get into this group?
I was lucky. Suzanne was at a Christmas cookie decorating party in the city, and she asked a woman there if she knew any Jewish women who wrote children's books. And I fit that description, so this woman gave Suzanne my phone number. Suzanne called me one day out of the blue and said, would you like to get together and talk about the three Abrahamic religions with me and Rania? I'd never heard the word Abrahamic before, but I quickly got the gist of it, and I said, sure. And they really rescued me. I was in my own state of panic, and I really came to it out of a sense of fear after September 11th. It had stirred up so much anxiety in me that I felt the whole world was screaming about religion. I had two teenage sons. I wanted to know that they could be safe and that my anxiety wouldn't rub off on them, and that if I talked to these women quietly, maybe something would come of it.
So for each of you, in some ways, what this introduced was the opportunity not so much to look at other religions as to look at your own.
Well, that's the irony of it. And the beauty of it is that an interfaith dialogue, instead of threatening your own religion and your faith, it actually strengthened it. Because by pushing ourselves outside our comfort zones, we end up having true ownership of our own religions and feeling that confidence and security that comes out of it. So I like to say that when I first started out, I used to describe myself as someone who had faith but no religion. And yet today, because of the faith club, I am today someone of faith and religion. I know that Islam within it has the tenets, and at its core can support my faith in a universal God.
I walked into this conversation in a different way, though, very confident with where I was in my Christian faith. And the surprise to me was my conversations with a Muslim and a Jew led me to a new understanding of Christian faith that I hadn't anticipated at all. I came to learn about Islam and Judaism. And then as we talked and talked, I actually reached a real crisis as we went over complicated issues and language and things that I had accepted my entire life and had to unlearn, re-explore, to articulate them in a way that was meaningful to me. So I was reassured in my crisis of faith by a priest who said to me, the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty.
And Priscilla, you said you weren't even aware of the term Abrahamic when this began.
No, I had gone, I thought I was an open-minded person, and I thought I knew a fair amount about religion. I'd gone to a Hebrew day school, an Orthodox Hebrew day school from third through sixth grades. And then I went to a Quaker girls' school from 7th till 12th grade. So I went from studying the Torah in Hebrew to singing songs to baby Jesus at Christmas time and silent meetings. And the irony of my experience was that I came into this thinking I was open-minded and very quickly realizing that, in fact, I held stereotypes, as we all do. And originally, the first conflict that happened in the book came between me and Suzanne.
Can we talk about that a little bit? Can
sure.
you explain?
That's a tenet of a faith club. You have
yeah.
to... No, I mean, nothing is, you can ask whatever you like.
Well, the stereotypes are maybe the most difficult thing to get across because we all have them and don't recognize them, I suppose. But can you tell me what they were?
Well, originally, I guess the first person I stereotyped was Suzanne because we were writing a story, we were writing a children's book. So Suzanne was writing about Jesus, Rania was writing about Muhammad, and I was writing about Moses. And when Suzanne read aloud her story, when she got to the part of the crucifixion, it stirred up some sort of very primal anxiety in me about Jews being accused of being Christ killers. And I said to Suzanne, you know, this is really upsetting to me. And first I said, can you leave the crucifixion out, which shows you that I didn't learn quite as much as I thought I had at the Quaker school. And she explained to me, in fact, that was rather a crucial element to her Christian beliefs. So I said to her, you know, this is making me really uncomfortable. And haven't you ever heard the word Christ killer? And she'd never heard the word. Well, I took the fact that she'd grown up in the Midwest and gone to all Catholic schools and then Texas Christian University. I took those facts and I put them together with my own insecurity about anti-Semitism, I suppose. And I wondered if she, in fact, harbored anti-Semitic thoughts. And it was a painful process. And I actually pressed her and we had a conversation about it, many.
I'm watching the two of you look at each other as your part of the conversation is going on, and I feel as though I really need to give Suzanne a chance to say what that conversation was like.
It was a surprise to me to try to understand Priscilla's reaction. I thought, well, I'm not an anti-Semitic. I certainly knew all about the Holocaust, but hadn't, I suppose, internalized as much, or the pogroms that had gone on in Eastern Europe and that sort of thing. Then understanding more in reading the Jewish prayer book and going to services with Priscilla, how that experience is woven into Jewish prayers, Jewish memories, and how that fed her reaction was a real learning experience for me. It, as Priscilla says, it taught us both to think of how words sound to different people.
Rania, you were at this conversation. You were watching this dialogue take
place. Quite a bit rather like the banished Ishmael, frankly, because here I was quite excited about the presence of these ladies, thinking we're going to explore so many issues between the Judeo-Christian and Muslim tradition. And that's exactly what I thought. Why couldn't it be the Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition? And I think at some point I even said that to Priscilla, and she said, well, we're discussing a really salient point here between the Judeo-Christian Christian, not the Judeo-Muslim, you know, so it was, I was banished for a while. We did come around, though, to a few stereotypes eventually. I played the peacemaker, ironically. Yeah, the Muslim was the peacemaker between the Jewish and the Christian mother, and I like to think that I helped keep the project together.
Now, this all began as an effort to write a book that would help your children understand the differences and the similarities, the points of conjunction. What did you finally decide, Priscilla, was most important to tell your children?
I think it took many years for me to get to what the salient points were. And really, I don't think that I was as well equipped then as I am now after going through this, my own journey, defining my own faith. I think now I'm much better equipped to tell my children the salient points, which we often agree on, which is that we are basically all living by the golden rule, that none of us have a knowledge of the truth, of the true path to God, and no one should judge anyone else's journey, whatever it is that they're on, as long as we treat each other with dignity and compassion and respect.
Do you agree?
I do agree, but it was difficult getting through those stereotypes before we got to that point. We sort of brushed over, when we're talking about stereotypes, the Muslim stereotypes, which took up a few good chapters of the book.
This is true. I haven't had a chance to. Again, the banished one. Yes, and I think that the danger with the Muslim stereotypes, even I as a Muslim perhaps was vulnerable to that stereotype, the stereotype that would have you believe that maybe you have to wear a veil a certain way or eat a certain way or live a certain lifestyle in order to qualify. And the biggest gift I have from the Faith Club experience is that I am very confident, very aware of the fact that diversity is just as possible to Muslims as it is to the Orthodox, Reform or conservative Jews or in the many denominations within Christianity. But there is good reason why we're all held to this notion, the stereotype, there's only one way to be, because there are literal voices out there who happen to have, unfortunately, a lot of oil money, who want you to believe that there is one way to be Muslim and only one way. And so I've been liberated, so to speak, because of the Faith Club. And I have an imam. I'm not just one lone voice. I have an imam who very much supports and a thriving American Muslim community that have embraced me and I've embraced them.
Rania Idlibi, Suzanne Oliver, and Priscilla Warner. They've written a book about their experience together called The Faith Club. How should we think about a story in the Bible that calls for human sacrifice? Coming up, a religious scholar wrestles with a story of Abraham and Isaac. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
God tested Abraham. He said to him,
Abraham.
Here I am,
he replied. Then God said,
take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain.
What do you make of this Bible story when God calls upon Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac?
He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven,
Abraham, Abraham.
Here I am,
he replied.
Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him.
Yes, Mother.
Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son.
I have to say, I have always found the story of Abraham and Isaac to be one of the most disturbing stories in the Bible. And I'm not alone. Bruce Chilton says this particular story has incited much of the violence committed in the name of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Chilton is a professor of religion at Bard College and the author of the book Abraham's Curse. He told Steve Paulson that the story of Abraham and Isaac has inspired generations of religious martyrs.
It is one of the most important origins of religious violence today. And that's a provable matter. One can actually see people referring to the text as they move out either to martyr themselves or to offer their children.
Give me some examples of this. Where have you come across references like these?
For example, in the letter that was found in Mohammed Atta's luggage at Logan Airport after the attacks on 9/11, part of the advice given to the attackers was that they should, quote, keep their knife sharp so that they should not cause their victim to suffer. That's a picture of deliberate sacrifice. Similarly, Meir Kahane wrote to his own son in God's name, telling him to be ready to be martyred. So it's not as if we're dealing with something which is today unique to Islam. So we see complete the understanding of Isaac as being a martyr, which every Jew should be prepared to emulate as an example. And this, of course, is a major background of Christianity, where the proud comparison was made that while the Hebrew text of Genesis 22 speaks of only a near sacrifice, Jesus himself was the perfect sacrifice. And because he was, every believer had to be willing to resist persecution even at the price of blood. So it comes as no surprise when the Quran develops at a later period. It takes the example of Ibrahim's action and also makes that into a model for how a good Muslim, following the example of the son whom Islam conceived as being there on the mountain with his father, namely Ismail, should also be willing to engage in struggle until the point of death. This is the move, I think, which is made in all three Abrahamic traditions, which makes these religions different from others. Mm-hmm. Most religions have a story somewhere about human sacrifice. It's present in Greek religion. It was in the religion of Carthage. It's there in Japan, in Hinduism, in Buddhism. But the Abrahamic religions make the move of seeing martyrdom as being either the duty or the potential duty of every single believer. We are violent religions. That's the simple fact of the matter.
In some ways, I understand this impulse, where it came from originally. I mean, why certain ancient religious leaders would have called upon their people to become martyrs. I mean, all of these religions were persecuted at one point or were at war with rival religions, rival sects who wanted to wipe them out. And arguably, you needed people willing to die for their religion if it was going to survive. I mean, it's at a certain basic level that makes sense, but it doesn't seem to make sense in the modern world today. I mean, it seems like we have moved way beyond that, and the persistence of the story and the persistence of the call for martyrdom just seems so troubling.
It's deeply troubling. Every time there's been an advance in warfare, the tendency to give one's own life, to take a life, has become more deadly.
You are a Christian yourself. To be blunt about this, wouldn't it be better off when you read the Bible and talk about it with the people in your church just to skip over this passage, just to forget it because it is so problematic?
Can't we quietly pretend it really isn't there?
Right.
I think that is a tendency among many people of generous spirit and good heart when they encounter passages in their own tradition that they find difficult. However, I think that is less than honest, and over the long term, it's deeply counterproductive. Because whatever parts of our tradition we do not actively cope with ourselves, we are leaving to others to do with what they will. And that is precisely what's happened in the case of this story, which doesn't feature a great deal, I have to say, in interfaith discussion, because clergy reflexively wish to present their religions as being moderate, as being peace-loving, as being tolerant. So I think we need precisely to confront those parts of our tradition which give us difficulty.
Okay, but I'm still trying to figure out how you yourself come to terms with this passage. I mean, in good faith, being honest about it. I mean, is there some way to reclaim it in a positive way?
Yes, I think there is, and I think that all three traditions show a way to do that. Within the Jewish tradition, Abraham is not portrayed in the way that he is now, namely as being a hero. By the time that this story is told in Genesis 22, Abraham has engaged in actions which are worse than dubious. He has tried to pass off his wife Sarah as being his sister to Abimelech, the king of Gerar, to avoid difficulty with him. But he's trying to do this, offering his wife for sexual relations at a time when she is actually pregnant with Isaac. He has driven out his older son, Ishmael, and that son's mother, Hagar, from where he was living. It nearly resulted in their deaths. So that when the original reader of Genesis 22 encountered that text, what he encountered was a text that caused Abraham to change his action. And it was the change of the action, the intervention which makes him see this is not desired by God and never will be, that represents the true climax of Genesis 22.
Well, that's an interesting interpretation. You're suggesting that it was Abraham himself who changed from being willing to kill his son to not killing his son to rejecting the violence, whereas usually I think the interpretation is he's all too willing to do it, but then the angel intervenes and tells him not to. I mean, it doesn't seem like—
And causes him to change.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a noble action at all.
That's right. And that's the point of the story. The light cast at the end of the story shows that it was never a noble action. It was a matter of going in exactly the wrong direction.
And what about in the Christian tradition? Do you see a different way of coming to terms with this story?
I do, especially in the story regarding Jesus just prior to his death. Although all the elements are present which will result in the crucifixion, Jesus does not approach that moment as if it were predetermined. And instead, in a prayer that is repeated three times in Gethsemane, he asks for the cup to pass, for there to be a different resolution to what he needs to do in Jerusalem. This actually runs against the notion of Jesus going forward to martyrdom and never doubting what was going to happen. It runs against the tradition that he had a precise foreknowledge of everything that was to take place. It was an important picture within the early church because those who actually lived during the period of martyrdom did not blatantly encourage all Christians to become martyrs. Thousands died, but many, many more than that lived, survived during the time of Roman persecution.
What about for Muslims today? What would be a better way to read the story other than just simply saying, oh, this is a recipe for martyrdom?
I think it's all the more vital in the case of Islam today because the issue of martyrdom has become more crucial. But here, the structure of the Quran itself is what shows us the way forward, because the Quran is the clearest of all the interpretations that the original impetus to offer the Son did not come from God, did not come from Allah himself. Instead, in that chapter, in that surah of the Quran called Al-Safat, when the Son is born, and it has been granted to Ibrahim by Allah, the Son grows, and one day Ibrahim says to his son, "Look, I see in a vision that I sacrifice you. What is your vision?" And the son goes on to tell Ibrahim that he should do as he was commanded. They go through the story until the point of sacrifice, and then Allah intervenes to prevent the action. In other words, the Quran is the clearest of all the stories that the instinct to sacrifice was Abraham's. It really was not God's. And this section of the Quran closes by saying, "Inna hadha lahuwa al-balu'a al-mubin," that is, this clearly was an obvious test. And it defines test to mean that Abraham learned how not to sacrifice and never to sacrifice a child again.
Bruce Chilton, talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Abraham's Curse. Chilton teaches religion at Bard College, and he's rector at the Church of St. John in Barrytown, New York.
Abraham took his only son high upon a hill. His test of faith had finally come as the wind began to chill. Abraham most mysteriously laid down that deadly knife. Said, "My darling son, I wish I was the one who spared your precious life."
So, what do you think? What should we make of the story of Abraham and Isaac? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Up next, the story of how two young men, a Catholic and a Jew, became friends through their common yearning for the transcendent. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Our theme this hour is how people from different religions can reach out and talk with each other. Now, you might not think Peter Biebergall and Scott Korb would have much to say about religion. They seem to be thoroughly secular young men. They're both writers who love to gab about rock and roll, sex, and pop culture. But it turns out that faith and their search for God is what brought them together as friends. The added twist is that Peter is Jewish and Scott is Christian. Now they've written a book called The Faith Between Us. Biebergall told Dan Strangchamps that it wasn't easy to start this dialogue.
We found that in our lives independently before we even met that we had become embarrassed about having our religious life. Our friends knew more about our sex lives than they did about our religious lives. But I had best friends that knew, you know, what kind of sex toys my wife and I bought, but they didn't know that I prayed. And we didn't realize how much of a disconnect there was until we met each other.
Was it hard to kind of come out to each other?
Yeah, Peter and I had been friends for, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 months. I started working as his editor. I was publishing a small literary magazine at the time. And our friendship had nothing to do with God for those 8 to 10 months.
So was there a moment when one of you said to the other, "So, do you ever pray?"
Well, that isn't the exact question, but it's a very similar one. We had gotten to the point where we were talking on the phone fairly regularly, and one day we had let enough slip, one that I was teaching catechism at my church, that I was going to church at all, that Peter would, you know, go to synagogue on Yom Kippur. And one day we were talking on the phone, and Peter tells a story, well, I'll tell it for him, but that his son was sitting at his feet playing with a Batman toy, and he just decided that that was the time that he would ask me, not if I prayed, but if I believed in God.
What did you say?
Well, I said yes. And at the time, I believed in God in a different way than I do now, but it sort of didn't matter. I mean, the spirit of the answer was still the same, and that is, yes, I believe in holiness. I believe in the will of God, and I believed in it then in sort of more literal terms, but now in sort of metaphorical terms.
It's funny the way you're describing it. It's a moment of such intimacy between two men.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's funny. A lot of people have commented that for them has what has been the most profound aspect of the book was less the religious stuff and more about just the kind of intimacy that we have as friends and that we're men. And I think that having to be vulnerable around issues of spirituality and religion, once you're vulnerable about that, there's nothing else that you have to feel like you have to protect anymore.
You're both coming from pretty different religious traditions. Peter, you're Jewish. Scott, you're Catholic. Both Abrahamic traditions, but still very different religions. Do those backgrounds pose any problems for the ways you end up talking about faith?
They didn't at first, but they have begun to more now, believe it or not. Well, there's two things to that. I think that it's been easier for Scott to participate in Jewish rituals, say with my family when we do Friday night Shabbat. I think it's been much easier for him to participate in that than it has for me to participate in Christian worship, because there does seem to suggest a more literal engagement often with Christian liturgy than, say, with the Jewish one. But recently, I want to tell you a story which I think highlights this. Scott and I were driving from Chicago to Wisconsin, and we had a long time to talk and have an argument about what it meant to believe. Now that, you know, our faith in God is different from what it had been, say, when we even first met and when we began writing this book together, I was trying to understand what Scott meant by not being able to believe in a personal God and how he had arrived at that by slowly giving up belief in some of the miracles that you read about in the New Testament. That he didn't start with not believing in God. He started with not believing that Jesus literally raised Lazarus from the dead or that turned the
water into wine,
things like that. And it slowly that brought him to an idea that God itself was this miraculous business, that once he put aside all the miracles, that was the last miracle to go. And I couldn't understand that because for me, God wasn't about miracles, that to believe in God didn't have anything to do with miracles. And Scott was finally able to explain to me that for him, belief in God was always about belief in Jesus. And as a Jew, that's the ultimate disconnect, I think, between the Jewish and Christian theologies. That we don't have, that the Jewish people don't have that intermediary that for many Christians is the only way in which you can understand God.
Well, right? So were you tempted to say to Scott, well, maybe you're not Catholic then anymore, maybe you're a Jew?
That's, you know, every time you're the fifth person that I've told that story to that has said, maybe Scott's a Jew.
Maybe you converted him.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. There's this website that I'm sure it's well known, BeliefNet. And several years ago, we both took this quiz on BeliefNet, which is it tells you what religion you really are. And it turns out we're both Quakers when it comes to
liberal Quakers.
Well, it's funny because you also write, I think somewhere in the book, Peter, that you've experienced sometimes jealousy of Scott's Christianity, that Christianity seems like a more emotional kind of
it's
religion.
It's more emotional. In Judaism, many times, especially in moments of prayer, you're really confronted with, you know, what mythologically, you know, Jews have always talked about as, you know, the Leviathan, or what Job encounters with this God that is so vast and unknowable that you can just hope that he's even hearing this prayer, if at all. Whereas for Christians, especially Catholics, you get all these saints, you get Mary. There's all these intercessions to, you don't never even have to think about God at all.
And Peter was mentioning before the literalness of Christianity, the saints literally having existed and now intercessing or interceding with God, Mary literally having been a person and now interceding with God. What Judaism still offers me, I think what I've learned from Peter, almost the most, is how to appreciate mythology as mythology, you know, as it was written. These are stories that teach us how to live in the world. They're not stories that tell us where Jesus was born or when Jesus was born.
So, Scott, you call yourself a Catholic atheist, by which I take it to mean that you think of yourself as primarily culturally Catholic, but you've lost your actual belief in a God. And yet, it sounds like together you all had arrived at a vision of faith that didn't have to be so literal. So what is there in Peter's view of God that you can't believe in?
I think it's the actual sense that there is a transcendent world. That world is the wrong word, and I think everything I say will probably be the wrong word, but that there is some kind of actual literal transcendence that gets beyond our human experience. In that conversation that Peter and I had, we talked about how, and this is something that I couldn't believe in, I guess, and how transcendence sort of rests on earthly experience, so, sort of like a meniscus or something. They touch somehow. That I couldn't, I can't feel that weight of God.
The pressure, that's how we described it. For me, I can feel or I understand or I sense, or it's been my experience, that the divine exerts a pressure on the human in some way. Now, I will say that I believe the only way we can talk about that is metaphorically. I don't think anything we can ever say about that relationship that we have with the divine, there's no word that fully captures it. It's all metaphor. But I do believe that that thing exists beyond the metaphorical language, whereas for Scott, there simply is the metaphorical language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without anything behind it.
So then why do you remain interested in religion at all?
I grew up with religion, and there were these stories that are eternally true, if I can put the word eternally in quotation marks. And I was raised as a Catholic, and my ethics are rooted in Catholicism, and my life, the year is rooted in Catholicism. You know, how I place myself in a week is rooted in worship. It's rooted in, you know, really in some ways just about belonging.
So you're sort of making a distinction between faith as something you believe and faith as something you do.
Yeah. Faith and belief are not the same. I like to think of faith as rooted more in faithfulness. Mm-hmm. That faith without faithfulness, which means keeping your obligations, basically. So Peter actually, as a Jew, makes me a more religious Catholic because he simply provides me an opportunity to live my faith out in simple ways, by remembering birthdays, by making phone calls, by knowing and loving his son and his wife.
And I think that the other part of that is that the faithfulness and the way in which we relate to each other and to our families and to our friends, that there are those particular encounters that we have in those relationships, like birth and death, which are the big ones. There's something for us about religious language that best captures how we understand those experiences.
You're both really describing a life that revolves around the moments when we feel the holiness of life, you know, which is kind of separate from what you actually believe about whether there is or isn't a God and what that God might be. Do you experience those moments of holiness at times unrelated to religion? I mean, for instance, you primarily connected around music originally, you know, rock and roll, jazz, you're both big music lovers. Does music ever seem to you like a religious experience?
Sometimes it's the only religious experience.
Peter has always had, I think, a deeper relationship with music. I think one that, for him, goes back further in his life. And so I've looked to Peter a lot for music lessons, in a sense, how to listen to music, where to find the holiness. So it's something we've recently been calling the ache, that there are certain songs that just ache.
That sometimes I've never felt, even in the most you know, beautiful religious services sometimes still don't compare with what it's like to listen to Kind of Blue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's something about that human expression with transcendence, with capturing something that's beyond the human and pointing it into this human language, which is music.
But am I right that Peter believes that there, in a sense, there is an answer to that longing, that there is something that exists that we're longing for? And Scott, you believe that we have the longing, but there is no answer.
Yeah, it's all.
I think
that's a great way to put it. Yeah, this is a constant longing.
And yet, what we, as two people from completely different traditions, can connect on is the longing,
mm-hmm.
that we identify with that, and that in the end, it doesn't matter whether or not each of us believes the same thing about what's at the other side of it, because that doesn't have anything to do with our lives here together. What has to do with our lives here together is listening to that music.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means to be alive.
Brother.
You're listening to a song called Two-Headed Boy by one of Peter and Scott's favorite bands, Neutral Milk Hotel. Scott Korb and Peter Biebergall talked with Anne Strainchamps about their book, The Faith Between Us.
And when we pray, we'll wait for our miracle. God is a place where some
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Talking Across Religions, number 323A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.